Welcome back, everybody, to the Deep Dive. Today, we are going to be looking at some really interesting Supreme Court cases that deal with individual rights balanced against the interests of the state.
Absolutely.
And we've got two really fascinating cases here.
Yep.
We've got Easley v. Cromartie, which deals with the always kind of sensitive and tricky topic of race and redistricting.
Yeah, very much so.
And then we've got Shaw v. Murphy, which kind of takes us into a completely different world, the world of prisoners' rights and the First Amendment.
Yes, looking at the balance of rights within a correctional setting.
Exactly. So we've got these two very different worlds, but as we'll see, they kind of touch on some similar themes.
Definitely. And I think what ties them together is the court's approach to balancing these competing interests in both of these cases.
Okay, so let's jump right in.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with Easley v. Cromartie. This case comes out of North Carolina in the wake of the 1990 census.
Okay.
And they had to redraw their congressional district. And they created this new district, District 12, which had a sizable black population, like 47%.
Uh-huh.
And pretty much right away, the question arose, you know, was race the main reason they drew the district this way? Or was it just politics as usual?
Yeah, that's the core of it, right? Because mm-hmm. as we know, especially in certain places, race and politics can be so closely linked.
Yeah, exactly.
So the big legal question was whether race was like the driving force, the predominant factor behind District 12's boundaries.
Okay, so how did they untangle that?
Well, it's really tricky, right? Because North Carolina at the time had this, you know, huge overlap between race and party affiliation.
Yeah.
Like a vast majority of black voters were Democrats.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, you know, how do you definitively prove mm-hmm. the legislature was being intentionally discriminatory when they're also trying to create a district that favors their party?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
It is. And the lower courts, they initially said, yep, this is racial gerrymandering.
Oh, okay.
But then the Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, you got it wrong.
Wow, okay.
They overturned the lower court's decision, saying their finding was clearly erroneous.
Clearly erroneous. So what did the Supreme Court see that the lower courts missed?
Well, a few things. The Supreme Court really zeroed in on that overlap between race and political party in North Carolina. They said, look, it's just too hard to separate the two in this situation.
Okay, so they're saying just because a district has a majority of a certain racial group and they tend to vote a certain way doesn't automatically mean it was drawn with race as the primary goal.
Exactly. More nuanced than that. You can't just assume causation based on correlation.
That's a good point.
Then the Supreme Court pointed out a problem with the evidence the lower courts used. They were looking at voter registration data.
Okay.
But the Supreme Court said that's not enough.
Yeah.
You need to look at actual voting patterns to really understand what's going on.
Right, because just because someone registers as a Democrat doesn't mean they always vote Democrat.
That's right. Registration doesn't necessarily reflect how people actually behave at the ballot box.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court wanted more concrete proof of discriminatory intent.
So they were looking for evidence of how people actually voted, not just how they were registered.
Exactly. And this brings us to another crucial point. The burden of proof on the plaintiffs was super high.
Oh, okay.
They had to show that race was the dominant factor, not just a factor in how the district was drawn.
Oh, wow.
And the Supreme Court said there was no smoking gun evidence.
What does that mean, smoking gun evidence?
You know, explicit statements from lawmakers saying, hey, let's draw this district to benefit or harm a particular racial group.
So like memos or emails or something.
Yeah, something that showed their main goal was racial and not political.
Got it.
And the court also said, hey, a funky district shape or splitting up counties doesn't automatically equal racial gerrymandering. You know, sometimes you get weird shapes just from regular political gerrymandering too.
Ah, okay. So you can't just look at the shape of a district and assume it was racially motivated.
Right. The shape alone isn't enough.
Yeah.
You need more substantial evidence.
Okay. So Easley v. Cromartie essentially set a really high bar for proving racial gerrymandering, especially when race and politics are so intertwined.
Yeah, you need clear, direct evidence that race was the number one driving force, not just something that happened to coincide with political strategy.
It seems like a tough standard to meet.
It is. And it shows how cautious the courts are about interfering with redistricting decisions made by legislatures. They're not going to step in unless there's really strong evidence of unconstitutional racial intent.
Got it. Okay, so let's shift gears now and talk about Shaw v. Murphy. This one takes us into the world of prisons and the First Amendment.
Yeah, very different context.
Totally. So this case boils down to whether prisoners have a special First Amendment right when it comes to giving legal advice to other inmates.
Right.
The case centers around this inmate, Kevin Murphy, who got in trouble for sending a letter to another inmate. And in the letter, he was critical of a guard, and he also offered some legal help. So this raised the question, you know, does giving legal advice in prison deserve extra First Amendment protection compared to other types of inmate speech?
Yeah, does it elevate that type of speech to a higher level?
Right.
And the Supreme Court, they said, no, there's no special super right for legal talk in prison.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Justice Thomas, he wrote the majority opinion, and he explained the court's reasoning. They said the Turner v. Safley test is the standard for judging prisoners' constitutional rights.
Okay, so what's the Turner test again?
Right, so the Turner test basically says a prison regulation that limits an inmate's constitutional rights is okay as long as it's reasonably related to legitimate penological interests.
Oh, okay.
So basically they're looking at whether the rule makes sense for running a safe and orderly prison.
Okay, so it's like a balancing act between the inmate's rights and the prison's need to keep things running smoothly.
Exactly. And importantly, the court said the Turner test doesn't care what the speech is about. It applies equally to all types of speech, even legal advice.
So they're not giving special treatment to legal talk.
Right. They said giving extra protection to legal correspondence could really mess with the prison's ability to maintain order and security.
How so?
Well, think about it.
Yeah.
Even with mail screening, legal letters can be used to sneak in coded messages or inappropriate stuff disguised as legal advice.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean.
And the court really emphasized the need to trust prison administrators.
Yeah.
You know, they're the ones dealing with these complex and often dangerous environments. They know best how to handle communication within the prison.
Yeah, that makes sense.
They're the experts on the ground.
So in Shaw v. Murphy, they basically said, we're going to give prison officials a lot of leeway in regulating speech as long as their rules are reasonable and related to legitimate prison concerns.
Yeah, they're saying, we trust you to know what you're doing.
Now, Justice Ginsburg, she wrote a concurring opinion in this case. While she agreed with the majority's outcome, she did bring up a separate point about the prison's insolence rule.
Right, she had a different angle.
Yeah, so what was that all about?
So while Ginsburg agreed that there's no special First Amendment right for inmate legal help, she pointed out that the prison's rule against insolence could be a problem. She questioned if it was too vague, particularly as it was applied to Murphy in his letter.
So she wasn't taking issue with the overall concept of restricting speech in prison. She was more concerned with the specific rule they used to punish Murphy.
Exactly. Mm. She was saying, hey, this rule might be too broad and unclear. It could be used unfairly against inmates.
Okay, so why is that procedural point important?
Well, it leaves the door open for future challenges to how prison rules are actually used. Even though Murphy lost on his main First Amendment argument, inmates could still argue that a specific rule like this insolence one is so vague that it violates their due process rights.
So even if the broad principle of restricting speech is upheld, there can still be legal battles over how those restrictions are put into practice?
Yes. It highlights that there's still room for debate and litigation about the details of how these broad legal principles are implemented in real-life situations.
Interesting. Okay, so the takeaway from Shaw v. Murphy is that the Turner test is still the go-to framework for looking at prisoners' First Amendment rights.
Right.
And it doesn't carve out any special exceptions for legal advice. Prison rules that restrict speech will generally be okay as long as they're reasonably connected to legitimate penological interests and inmates still have other ways to exercise their rights.
That sums it up well. And the court is basically saying, we trust prison officials to manage their facilities effectively and will only step in if their regulations are clearly unreasonable or excessive.
Okay, so we've got these two seemingly different cases, Easley about redistricting and Shaw about prisoners' rights. What are some of the common threads you see running through them?
What's really striking is that both cases demonstrate a significant amount of judicial deference.
Deference, like they're giving a lot of weight to the decisions of other branches of government.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In Easley, the court showed deference to state legislatures and their decisions about redistricting. They set a high bar for intervention, recognizing the complexity of balancing racial and political considerations.
Yeah. And in Shaw, we see deference to prison officials and their expertise in maintaining order and security. The court's not eager to second guess them unless there's a clear violation of the Constitution.
Right. In both cases, the courts are acknowledging the practical challenges and expertise of the other branches of government.
So it's like the courts are saying, we'll give you space to do your jobs as long as you're not clearly overstepping your bounds.
That's a good way to put it.
So for all our law student listeners out there, these cases offer some really important lessons.
Absolutely.
Easily is a great example of different standards of judicial review. It shows how tough it is to overturn a lower court's factual findings. You need that clearly erroneous standard. And then Shaw demonstrates the more deferential Turner test. It shows how context really matters in legal analysis. The level of scrutiny the courts apply can change a lot depending on what rights are at stake and what the government's interests are.
Yeah, very good points. And I think for anyone studying law, these cases really underscore the importance of understanding not just the rules themselves, but how they're applied in different situations.
So as we wrap up today's deep dive, I want to leave you with a question to ponder. Given what we've seen in Easley and Shaw about the varying levels of judicial deference, what factors do you think have the most influence on how closely the courts will scrutinize government actions that affect our individual rights? It's a question worth thinking about as you continue on your legal journey.
Absolutely. It's a question that goes to the heart of the balance of power in our system and how we protect individual liberties.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me. It's been a great discussion.
Absolutely.